Do you know about these stories? In 1933, Huey Long invented a holiday to prevent a bank from collapsing. In 1963, years before he was assassinated, someone tried to kill JFK with a car bomb. And in 2014, remember this? There was a whole news cycle about President Obama's tan suit. On the podcast This Day in Esoteric Political History, we talk about the forgotten stories that may teach us a lot about the very strange moment we're living in right now. Check it out. This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia.
The Israel-Hamas war is entering its fifth month, and parents in both Gaza and Israel are trying to support their children.
As a father, I'm responsible to provide safety, at least for my children, because we don't have a home anymore. We don't have a house anymore to go back for.
I don't know what it is. It does not feel appropriate to feel okay right now. It does not feel right.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the latest country to abolish the death penalty and how a new professional women's hockey league is trying to make an impact.
Whenever I watch hockey, it's usually like the Bruins and there's never any women playing on the ice.
Plus, a criminal lawsuit filed on behalf of victims from the earthquakes in Turkey last year, and China flexes on smartphone microchips.
All that and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Washington's top diplomat is once again in the Middle East, trying to find a way to pause the bloody war between Israel and Hamas. That effort hit another obstacle today when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected demands from Hamas for a ceasefire. "We are on the way to an absolute victory," he said. "There is no other solution."
Israel has signaled that it's planning to expand operations in the city of Rafah in far southern Gaza. About 1 million Palestinians are crammed into that city near the Egyptian border after repeatedly being told to move south. And now they say they have nowhere left to flee.
"We are literally trapped between Israeli tanks and Egyptian border in a very narrow piece of land. So what is the options that we have now? What is the solution for us when we are trapped here?"
Yosef Hamash is with an aid group called the Norwegian Refugee Council. He moved to Rafah with his family months ago. I spoke with him earlier today about what life is like there now.
"Last night it was a really heavy night. All of the night there was Israeli army was doing, as they call it, a fire belt, which is a continuously bombing in one area, which is literally an earthquake. Israeli tanks are less than 1 kilometer away from us, so I can clearly hear the clashes, the bombing, and the airstrikes is very clear. Every day, continuously, there is house targeting, or yesterday, for example, they attacked members of police who were escorting the aid truck. After they delivered it, they attacked them on their way back. Just one among many, many other attacks came into Rafah."
That must be terrifying to live through.
It is, but where are we going to go? One side we have the Israeli tanks, and the other side we have the Egyptian border. So what is the solution for us when we are locked here and all of the Israeli media and the Israeli spokesperson who's talking about the ground operation is going to take a place in Rafah as a next step? That's a huge concern for us because we ran out of solutions. We were running from a place to the other, from a place to the other. So where we are going to go now?
What are your options? I mean, if strikes become increasingly intense, what will you do?
Imagine a situation of a household, a head of a household, who doesn't have the ability to find the bread for his children. Since the Israeli media and everyone start to talk about the next step of the military operation in Rafah, I'm thinking how I'm going to provide safety and a shelter. And unfortunately, I don't have options. Either I have to go back to the middle area where the bombing is more intense, or I should find a solution to go back to the north or be killed by the Israelis on the way back, while 85% of the housing unit in the north and Gaza City were totally destroyed. So the other option is that the Israelis are going to start this ground operation in Rafah, and they will push everyone towards the Egyptian border. And I don't think we are welcomed there.
How old are your kids and how are they doing?
I have Ilya, 5 years old, and Ahmed, 2 years and a half. Yani, I also ran out of lies in front of my children, of justification for what's going on, where we are here, and when we are going to our home, because we don't have a home anymore. We don't have a house anymore to go back for. So even I still have that feeling in front of my children, somehow I'm useless. All what I can do is get some food, something to drink. If we were lucky, I would have biscuits. As a father, this is the only role that I can do. Even in terms of safety, I cannot protect them from airstrikes. And imagining my son, who's 2 years and a half, now can understand the difference between a tank shell or an airstrike. My son understands the noise of an airstrike, like there is bombing, that's an airplane. Our children went through, I don't think that anyone on this planet can handle it. And they are children. And all what we can do as father is to keep trying and trying to convince them that we are safe here, to provide them whatever we can. But unfortunately, it's not enough. And the feeling that you are useless in front of it, your children, is very painful. Hmm. We need years to recover mentally this war.
So when they ask you what happens next, or where can we be safe, or when does this end, what do you say to your kids?
I am lucky because they are young, 5 years old. Ilya just always asking about when you are going to our home. They don't ask more than that. I hope they are not going to grow under the circumstances. It's not only about the war itself. It's what's coming after. Before the war, Gaza was having one of the highest employment rate on this planet. We need years and years to recover.
When you do think about where you and your children will be in, say, 5 or 10 years, you know, so much of Gaza, as you say, has been destroyed. So even after this ends, do you still see yourself in Gaza?
I'll be honest with you. A few days ago, there is a news that was misquoted by one of the media outlets about a ceasefire. Everyone in Gaza thought that they both agreed and we have a ceasefire. Everyone started to shout, scream, whistling in the street because people are starving to have such a news. I had a different opinion towards that. When I didn't have internet connection, I thought it's a true news, and thousands of people were whistling, shouting in the street. So I thought, okay, that's a truth. There is a truce or a ceasefire. I start to think about what I have and what's coming next after this war. It was shocking even just to think about it. We don't have anything left for us. There is nothing remaining to us to build on. We have to start from the scratch. Mm. And it's not only about having a house. There is no infrastructure. There is no sewage networks. There is no water network. There is no electricity network. It's unimaginable situation that even I personally, I avoid thinking about that because now I'm on a survival mode. I keep convincing myself. Now my role is to secure my family needs, trying to survive. Then we will think about that. But I when I had the news that it's over, I sincerely believe that I'm not ready. Mm. I'm not ready. Mentally, we are not ready to start recovering or restoring our life. Somehow, unfortunately, we adapt as this is our reality now. In a war zone, all of my family is living in a tent. Now the Israeli army is announcing areas block by block. And it feels that we don't have any future remaining for us as Palestinians who are trapped now in Gaza.
You've said that there's nowhere left for you and the million other people crammed into Rafah to go. You're, you know, up against the Egyptian border. If there are increased strikes, what is your plan?
I don't know literally what's waiting for us in the next minute. I don't have any option or any idea what I'm going to do if the ground operation starts at Rafah. I have no solutions. It's really crazy, honestly, when you think about it. You feel that the world is collapsing.
That's Yosef Hamash, an aid worker and resident of Gaza, who's now sheltering with his children in the southern city of Rafah.
One man there doing his best to be a parent in Gaza right now. In Israel, the parents of hostages being held by Hamas are also grappling with the impact of this war. Here's Israeli President Isaac Herzog speaking alongside U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken today in Jerusalem.
I think your visit comes at a very critical moment in the conflict. We are yearning and praying for the immediate release of our hostages. We want to see them back as soon as possible.
One of the 250 or so people taken hostage by Hamas 4 months ago was 23-year-old Hirsch Goldberg Polan. His parents, Rachel Goldberg and John Polan, have become high-profile advocates for bringing Israeli hostages home from Gaza. Goldberg Polan was kidnapped from the music festival in southern Israel on October 7th. He lost an arm in that attack. In the fall, his parents sat down to speak with Israel Story, a radio show and podcast in Tel Aviv.
I'm Rachel. I'm Hirsch Goldberg Polan's mom.
I'm John. I'm Hirsch's dad and Rachel's husband.
I'm John's wife. Who are you? I remember saying, like, it's going to be horrible for a long time, and then we're going to be okay. One day we're going to be okay again. It's not going to be the rest of our lives. Look, I think to be known for something horrible is horrible. So that makes me sad, because either I'd like to be anonymous, or it would be nice to be known for something wonderful, not something that's everybody's worst nightmare. It is a slow motion, stretched out, agonizing, continual way of being.
And we made the decision by Saturday afternoon, October 7th, that we weren't going to wait around for the Israeli government or the U.S. government or anybody else to take action on our behalf. We said, we're taking matters into our own hands. We set up a situation room, and sometimes there are four people here, sometimes there are 14 people here. It depends on the day and the time of day. But we are constantly in action mode, whether it be reaching out to U.S. officials, reaching out to Israeli officials, finding foreign government officials that may be relevant players here, connecting with other hostage families to compare parts of the journey. We basically have said we need to tell the story, keep it front and center for the world, and we need to do everything we can to reach out to every influential person that we can that might ultimately be the person who could lead to the release of Hirsch.
He's going to hate it. All of his friends always say he is going to hate that he's everywhere, that you guys are everywhere, that, you know, that you've described him on all of these, you know, in all these articles and all these newscasts and all these things. We joke about it all the time. We say, like, first of all, God willing, I would love to deal with him hating it. Do you know what I mean? Like, he should come home healthy, soon, alive, one arm down, we'll deal with that. Trauma, we'll deal with it. But honestly, my normal way of being, when people say there's fight, flight, or freeze, I'm a freezer, usually. But I've never been in this situation before, and this is just primal. What we've been doing, it's not me. This is so not me to go and not be scared. I don't care who I talk to now. Like, the scariest thing on planet Earth has happened. So I don't care getting up in front of 300,000 people in D.C. My voice didn't shake. I don't care. I don't care getting up in front of the UN, up in front of the Pope. I don't care. I actually only feel comfortable physically when I don't feel comfortable. Like, I don't want to feel good because I know he doesn't feel good. So I can't even taste good food now. Like, I eat food in order to have eaten. But when I feel hungry, that's the only time I feel okay, because I feel, I don't know if it's guilty. I don't know what it is. It does not feel appropriate to feel okay right now. It does not feel right. And so when I'm uncomfortable, when I'm going to sleep and my stomach's growling, I feel good.
We don't exercise. We don't take any time of our own. We just don't. I keep saying next week, next week, next week, and it hasn't happened. Maybe next week.
So to be constantly busy and constantly running, constantly, it's actually better. The only thing that's sad is that when we do finally get into bed at night and take our pills that our doctor has given us to, like, knock us out, because otherwise we couldn't sleep, we always say to each other, well, I guess we failed, because he's not home, they're not home. So, like, we worked our asses off, and you fall into bed exhausted, and you know that you failed. It's the ultimate myth of Sisyphus. We wake up every morning, and we're like, okay, we're back to square one. Like, it doesn't matter what we did, we failed, because here we are.
That was Rachel Goldberg and John Polin. Their son is among 136 remaining hostages, living and dead, being held by Palestinian militants in Gaza. Find more of our reporting and perspectives on the war between Israel and Hamas online. Go to theworld.org. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Lunar New Year, or Spring Festival, is by far the biggest holiday in China, a time for food, family, travel, and celebration. It also means things definitely slow down for China's economy, and that impacts foreign businesses operating in China. We reached out to Jeremy Goldcorn to learn more. He's with the China File website and lived and worked in China for 20 years.
When I was first in China in the 1990s, it meant that almost every business completely shut down, including restaurants. And, you know, if you weren't prepared at home with food, you'd really struggle. Now there are still a lot of services that remain open, including a lot of restaurants. But most companies take the whole week off. There's a week-long national public holiday. And migrant workers who make up much of China's workforce start going home weeks before the actual holiday. So there's a sort of a feeling like you get in the United States in the weeks leading up to Christmas, but it lasts a bit longer because the holiday itself is the only real true holiday in China in some ways. It's like Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year all wrapped up into one.
So when you say migrant workers are returning to their homes, you're talking about migrant workers from other parts of China.
That's right. So a lot of the people who do a lot of the manual labor on construction sites, work in factories, do many of the service jobs, e-commerce delivery people, many of them don't come from the places where they work. They don't come from the big cities. They come from smaller cities or the countryside.
Yeah, I was going to ask you a moment ago, how different is Spring Festival in China compared to, say, Thanksgiving or Christmas? You compare them, but I mean, is it just a matter of scale?
It's a matter of scale because of all the people going home. It's often called the largest mass human migration on the planet. There is also a sort of a mindset. I mean, you have some idea in the United States where just before Christmas and New Year, people will often say, well, let's get back to it after the New Year. It's the same in China, but it often starts about a month and a half or 2 months before the Spring Festival. You start getting the answer when you're trying to get things done. Well, you know, sounds like a good idea, but let's wait until after the New Year.
Yes. So the impact of this outside of China, I mean, I see Maersk, the Danish shipping company, actually has on its website a calendar for manufacturers of what to expect starting in mid-January in China. Factories start slowing down production, and then people start going home. So what is the impact of Spring Festival on the global economy?
You've got to imagine that it affects trade all over the world because China still does supply so much of the world's manufactured goods. And if Chinese factories are out for a week and the people shipping the goods are out for a couple of weeks, it must create some kind of ripple in the entire system of global trade. You know, the savvy operator will prepare in advance. And if they know they're going to need stock, they'll get the stock in place before the slowdown starts. Because if you're unprepared, there's not really much you can do.
Meantime, I'm just wondering what the slowdown of China's economy means for this year's Lunar New Year celebrations for folks who may not have the disposable income to spend for like family dinners that they may have had a few years ago.
This is one time of year where people will do everything they can to show their family a good time, you know, including possibly eating into their savings. So I would imagine most Chinese families, you know, even if they're feeling a little less financially certain than last year, will still make sure they have a good time. But no doubt consumption will be down, and people have been talking in the last few years about consumption downgrades, of people just buying less expensive stuff. But they're still going to buy the stuff that they need to celebrate, that's for sure.
Is there anything about the Chinese Lunar New Year, this kind of celebration these weeks, that Westerners just might not understand?
Well, it's the one time of year when Chinese companies might turn down some business because they just want to have a good time. And that never happens at other times of year.
Jeremy Goldcorn is an editorial fellow with the China File website run by the Asia Society. He was explaining how the festivities at the Lunar New Year impact the Chinese businesses. Later this hour, the next generation of microchips that China could be developing.
In the world of women's hockey, it's been Team USA and Team Canada dominating international competition for decades. But both countries have struggled to keep professional leagues in business. The new Professional Women's Hockey League is looking to change that. The PWHL has six well-funded teams across Canada and the U.S. Its inaugural season is underway. The world's Bianca Hillier went to see a recent game outside of Boston.
Crowds of people line up outside the arena in Lowell, Massachusetts, waiting for the doors to open for a battle between the teams from Boston and Montreal. Among the fans is Alice, who is celebrating her 8th birthday at the game.
So why did you want to come here on your birthday?
I heard that there was going to be a women's hockey league, and I was really excited because whenever I watch hockey, it's usually like the Bruins, and there's never any women playing on the ice. I'm just really excited that there is a women's hockey league this year.
Would you want to maybe play hockey when you're older?
Yes.
Yes.
I want to be goalie.
Young, aspiring hockey players like Alice are certainly a key audience for the PWHL. But once inside the arena, I look around and notice a diverse group of fans.
There's people of all genders, all ages, from young girls to high schoolers to groups of adult friends who have told me that this is exactly what they want to be doing on a Sunday afternoon.
Jaina Hefford also spots groups of older women in the stands. She's the league's senior vice president of hockey operations.
We see a lot of women that probably play the game, but never had a chance to ever, you know, be a part of something like this because it was barely a dream at that point. So a lot of that sort of older generation that is so grateful and thankful to see this come to fruition.
Hefford, a 5-time Olympic medalist in the sport, says the league's impact will also be felt outside of North America.
In order to truly grow the game, you have to do it globally, and it can't just be about North America. So it's always been part of the vision that this would be a league that housed the best players in the world, regardless of where they came from.
The league's 157 players represent 12 countries, including China, Japan, Hungary, and France. Forward Alina Mueller is from Switzerland.
With the 3rd pick in the 1st round of the inaugural PWHL draft, Boston selects Alina Mueller.
On draft day, Mueller told the press she was proud to be the first European selected.
Yes, unbelievable. it's pretty emotional. Super happy.
Hefford calls Mueller one of the stars of the league and says players like her are a major part of growing the game internationally.
Having those players be able to come over here and gain the experience, play with and against the best players, and then they'll go home and share that and, you know, inspire many young girls to come and follow that path.
Montreal head coach Corey Chevry says the quality of the PWHL is already spreading to players around the world, and they have FOMO.
You're hearing the buzz of, well, I want to play in the PWHL next year. So I think it'll just continue to flourish and more players will want to continue to come over.
Chevry's team has 2 players from the Czech Republic. She knows the skills they're picking up in Canada will make a difference back home.
We want to be able to send them back to their national teams and say, wow, they're improving in Montreal and they're getting better. I mean, that just helps everybody in the global game.
The PWHL regular season is set to end in June, followed by playoffs and a championship final. Games are broadcast on TV across Canada and are streamed on the league's YouTube channel for fans across the globe. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Lowell, Massachusetts.
You're listening to The World.
As political scientists try to make sense of the rise in authoritarianism around the globe, a new biography of the French revolutionary Frantz Fanon is a timely one.
He was a psychiatrist, he was an anti-colonial militant, he was a theorist of racism, and he was a participant in one of the 20th century's great national liberation struggles.
The revolutionary lives of Frantz Fanon, still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It was 1 year ago that devastating earthquakes killed more than 59,000 people in Turkey and northern Syria. Since then, accountability has been elusive. But one group of parents whose children died in a collapsed hotel in Turkey are bringing the first criminal case of its kind. The victims were a visiting volleyball team from North Cyprus preparing for a tournament. The World's Duri Buscarin visited their hometown and filed this report.
Murat Akturala meets with other grieving parents to discuss their legal case in a small classroom next to the volleyball court where his son Aras used to play.
To be honest, being over here every day and hearing those voices, it's not easy.
In February of last year, boys and girls volleyball teams from Famagusta traveled to the eastern Turkish city of Adıyaman for a volleyball tournament. They were all between the ages of 11 and 14. Akhtarullah remembers helping them raise funds for the trip from neighbors and local businesses.
According to our budget, we decided to choose Isyas Hotel, unfortunately.
The Grand Isyas Hotel was one of the nicest places to stay in Adıyaman, a 10-floor hotel with good online reviews. On the bus from the airport, the kids sang along to Turkish pop songs. Akhtarullah joined as a parent chaperone.
My room was 3 and 10, our colleagues 2-9, 2-10, and 1-09.
The kids took rooms together in another part of the hotel. At 4:17 a.m., a massive 7.8 magnitude earthquake ripped across southern Turkey. Akhtarullah ran to the door to try and reach the kids, but couldn't open it. So he took cover between the beds.
And I was talking to the walls,
praying that the hotel would withstand the shaking.
And all of a sudden, it was like an atomic boom.
He was thrown onto his back. When he woke up, he says, everything was on top of him.
Tried to move my legs. I slid from the demolished parts of the building on me. And when I walked like a couple of steps, it was out of the building. I was at the top of the crash.
Akhtarullah emerged into a desolate landscape. Screaming his son's name, he and three more surviving parents spent hours trying to find their kids. The president of Northern Cyprus arranged a rescue team, which flew to Adıyaman that day with a group of parents, hoping to find the kids alive under the rubble. But their rooms had completely collapsed.
It was like a mountain with sand. Our kids and the parents and the teachers didn't have any chance to survive.
Ruşen Karakaya is the mother of Selin, a 14-year-old player on the girls' team.
They were found
in their sleeping positions.
Our kids didn't even open their eyes.
She says the parents had to identify their children from the color of their socks.
It's not fair. An earthquake didn't kill our kids. The building killed them. We're talking about murderers here. That's why we are right now fighting for justice.
A total of 72 people died in the collapse of the Grand Isyas Hotel, including the 24 volleyball players, 9 teachers and parents, a group of 40 tour guides in town for a training. Early on, Turkish authorities took the hotel owner into custody and charged him with the Turkish legal equivalent of negligent homicide, alongside his two sons and business partners. Hasan Esendala, who is part of the legal team on behalf of the parents, says they are making the argument that the hotel wasn't built safely, especially for an area with a known earthquake risk.
Şunlar tartışılıyor davada birazcık daha anlaşılabilir şekilde.
We're trying to figure out who is responsible, Esendala says, whether it was engineers who took part in the construction, the architect, or the municipality who gave permission. In the first hearing of the trial, the hotel owner said he believed that his hotel was the strongest building in the area. He argued that his hotel was built to code, but that in an earthquake of this magnitude, it was inevitable that some buildings would fall. He said that he, too, was grieving the deaths of his guests. In Famagusta, the parents say the hotel's owners have never contacted them, even to give condolences. Once in a while, Ruşen Karakaya lets herself drive to Selin's high school to sit in the parking lot where she used to pick her up.
I don't know how this happened. I mean, come on. We're talking about kids here, and they killed our kids for nothing. I want to pick her up again.
Because she can't, she says. She'll dedicate herself to seeking justice for all of the kids who died. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, North Cyprus.
Off the coast of Japan, a pod of killer whales is once more on the move. The orcas had been trapped in an ice drift not far from Japan's northern island of Hokkaido. A local fisherman spotted them yesterday morning and reported their plight to officials in the nearest town. 13 of the whales were bobbing up and down in a tiny gap surrounded by drift ice about half a mile offshore.
A conservation group used drones to track the animals while local officials monitored the coast. Their plight captured the attention of people across Japan and beyond. Some pled for the Japanese Defense Ministry to mobilize an icebreaker to help free the orcas. By yesterday evening, though, the pod had moved north, and by today, the killer whales were gone. Apparently, they freed themselves as the gaps in the ice grew bigger.
The United States has spent a lot of time and energy trying to prevent China from developing advanced computer technologies. It's enlisted a whole host of allies in Europe and Asia to do their part. Now comes a report in the Financial Times that China's biggest chip maker, SMIC, is poised to start making next-generation smartphone processors as early as this year. John Lee is a researcher at the Leiden Asia Center in the Netherlands. He says this report makes one thing clear.
Well, there's no question that the Chinese are not going to take lying down the restrictions that have been imposed by the United States and by several, let's say, like-minded countries over the last 2 years. It's simply a question of the technical complexity and the cost. But it would appear, and certainly there's some evidence of this in the public sphere in terms of papers published at industry conferences and so on, that the Chinese are finding a way to at least do limited production runs of so-called next-generation chips.
Yeah, just briefly remind us what those U.S. restrictions are.
So the restrictions that target China's entire economy as opposed to individual companies like Huawei date from October 2022, and those were updated in October 2023. Those are the American restrictions, and they were targeted at what we might call cutting-edge chips. The idea is basically to deny the Chinese both the ability to obtain these chips on the market or to acquire the ability to make them themselves. But semiconductor fabrication is a complicated business. And for various reasons, there have been continuing, in fact, increasing shipments of chip manufacturing equipment to China, which is one reason why the controls were updated, as I mentioned, in October 2023. Also, the Netherlands and Japan both brought in their own unilateral controls, which were reportedly based on negotiations with the United States in the first half of 2023. Taiwan has, as of December 2023, also brought in controls on sub-40 nanometer processors. So there would appear to be some level of coordination on the part of other countries, all of them, let's say, like-minded with Washington on the political side, with a view to restricting the ability of the Chinese semiconductor industry to advance.
So we're talking nanochips here, super small, but how advanced are these next generation smartphone processors that China may start making this year? What can they do that current processors can't?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to talk in terms of specific applications. Let's say that you're talking about the main processor in a recent generation smartphone within the last several years, for example, which is why you've read about the new Huawei smartphone lines, for instance, as if you like the demonstration case for this new Chinese fabrication capacity. But what's also been reported is that Huawei will be manufacturing, let's call them AI processor chips, to support cloud computing and artificial intelligence applications on these same processors by China's leading semiconductor fabrication provider, SMIC. And that has really caught attention because while smartphone is obviously a very desirable consumer device, if we talk about strategic implications and the international balance of power, then large-scale artificial intelligence capabilities and cloud computing is much more significant.
Yeah, so help us understand why the U.S. is so concerned about China developing cutting-edge computer technology.
Official justification in the export controls of October 2022, which was more or less repeated in 2023, was the need to prevent China acquiring cutting-edge military capabilities and specifically next-generation uses of artificial intelligence that would be enabled by access to the sorts of leading-edge processors that are fabricated at these advanced nodes. And also human rights justifications in terms of denying China, again, the technical capabilities to enable, for example, mass surveillance and human rights abuses that are associated with that. How convincing those arguments are is a whole separate conversation, but that was the official reason given. I think what's interesting to note, though, in terms of recent developments is that the focus, at least over the last couple of months in Washington, seems to have been turning more to those older generation fabrication technology and chips, which are not the very cutting edge in terms of node density and the fabrication technology, but which, again, may be of strategic implication to the United States. And so you see the discussion moving towards wider spectrum of fabrication technology and capacity and the implications this might have. But once you're talking about that, then I would suggest that the link back to advanced military applications becomes more tenuous, and you're really talking about a general economic security issue.
Is there a realistic scenario where there is room for China to develop as a technological giant alongside the U.S. and its allies?
I think it's important to bear in mind that we have, at best, a very partial controls regime targeting the Chinese chip sector at the moment. So the prospect of, if you like, a continually expanding envelope of U.S. controls, which is no longer linked to, very clearly at least, to advanced military applications, is going to make it a harder political sell, even to the advanced economies like Japan and the Netherlands, which we're talking about at the moment. Once you get to a wider range of countries, a lot of activity in the semiconductor supply chain, for example, happens in Southeast Asia these days. So you're talking about ASEAN economies like Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, whether they can be convinced to go along with U.S. priorities, again, which are no longer clearly linked to very advanced military applications, is a question that's going to be played out over the next few years.
John Lee is with the Leiden Asia Center in the Netherlands and a chief consultant at East-West Futures. He spoke to us from Berlin.
Zimbabwe is abolishing the death penalty. No one has actually been put to death in the country since 2005. But today, Zimbabwe's cabinet approved a move by parliament to do away with capital punishment completely. That leaves about 50 countries around the globe, including the United States, that still have the death penalty. Robin Marr is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington.
Well, I think Zimbabwe has joined the trend among both African countries and around the world in moving away from use of the death penalty. Since 1976, we've seen a number of countries abolish the death penalty. And the trend now is that more than 70% of the world does not use the death penalty.
So there are a little more than 50 countries that still have the death penalty. Where are those countries? Are there any trends regarding, you know, which countries still have the death penalty and which no longer do?
Well, the most frequent users of the death penalty are largely in Asia and in Africa. China continues to lead the world in executions, although the actual number is a state secret. We have seen an increase in the last couple of years, actually, with use of the death penalty worldwide, and that's largely down to a couple of countries. One is, of course, China always, but also Iran executed more than 700 people last year. So we see, much as we do in the United States, isolated use of the death penalty around the world.
Where does the U.S. stand in the ranking of the number of executions actually done each year?
Well, we are among the top executioners, although our numbers are quite small as compared to China or Iran. Last year, we executed 24 people. That number was slightly up from the previous year, but they are much lower than they were 20 years ago when we approached almost 100 executions. All of that reflects a continuing trend within the United States away from use of the death penalty. But in states where it continues, we are seeing executions in places like Alabama, which just used nitrogen gas to execute a prisoner for the very first time.
You've mentioned Iran, you've mentioned China. Is the U.S. the only advanced industrialized democracy that still has the death penalty?
Yes, it is. All of Europe, of course, is abolished with the exception of Belarus. Japan still also executes people, although it executed no one last year, leaving the United States as the only G7 country to have executions. So the U.S. is more and more in a minority of retentionist countries in the world.
How many countries have abolished the death penalty in the last 30 or so years?
Since 1976, 85 countries have abolished the death penalty for all crimes. That's considered to be the sort of modern death penalty era here in the United States. But that shows a really tremendous amount of progress. Of course, international law imposes severe limits on the use of the death penalty, and most will argue that the death penalty in general is a human rights violation. So we're seeing reductions in the number of crimes that are death eligible in many countries. We're seeing declines in the number of use and new death sentences, and of course, in the number of executions writ large.
So you follow this issue closely, obviously. What are you expecting to see in coming years in terms of death penalty law? Do you expect this decline to continue?
It's very hard to say. I think the death penalty has always been used as a political tool, and it always will be. By some political actors, they will seize upon the death penalty as an answer to concerns, very legitimate concerns about violent crime. But what we've seen is a better understanding that the use of the death penalty is expensive, it's often unfair, and it doesn't accomplish the goal of keeping people safer, which has always been held out to be the promise of the death penalty. As I've trained in countries around the world, I've seen the same kind of people that end up on death row. They are often people who are minorities within their communities. They are people with significant vulnerabilities. And we've also seen that defenders who represent people who are charged with the death penalty or on death row face some of the same challenges from their government. This is the biggest and most expensive use of government power to seek and secure a death sentence. And I think that many places are finding that there are better uses for that investment of funds than there is with the death penalty.
Do you think that there are certain countries that are close to abolishing the death penalty following in Zimbabwe's wake?
Well, I think the trend in Africa has been very much following the trend toward abolition. We've seen many statements from governments in Africa that have indicated a change in their view about its usefulness and the investment of resources that it takes. Uganda is at odds with the trend toward abolition in sub-Saharan Africa. It passed what they called the Anti-Homosexuality Act of 2023. And that made the death penalty a possible punishment for, quote, aggravated homosexuality. And we've already seen some people charged under this new law.
Robin Marr is executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center in Washington.
Coming right up on the show, the revolutionary life of a French psychiatrist whose work focused on the evil of colonialism. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Frantz Fanon is a name that we hear periodically, often in the context of conflict between the haves and have-nots. Fanon was born in the Caribbean in 1925. He went on to be a psychiatrist, an author, and an anti-colonial revolutionary who inspired generations of thinkers and activists. There's a new biography, The Rebels Clinic, The Revolutionary Lives of Frantz Fanon. Adam Schatz is the author. He opens the first chapter by reminding readers where Fanon came from, the city of Fort-de-France, the capital of Martinique.
Frantz Fanon was, first of all, a psychiatrist. He was a psychiatrist. He was an anti-colonial militant. He was a theorist of racism. And he was a participant in one of the 20th century's great national liberation struggles, the Algerian struggle for independence from France. But what I meant to emphasize with that remark was that Fanon was a West Indian, and his West Indian roots permeated his thinking about colonialism.
Yeah, what difference did that make, especially coming from Martinique, a French colony that remains still a French territory to this day?
Right. It made quite a difference because Fanon grew up in a place where essentially he was taught that he was just like any other Frenchman, that he was a French person of color, that his color really had no significance whatsoever. And he believed fiercely in France. He believed in, you know, liberty, equality, and fraternity. And he joined the Free French Forces to fight against fascism. But when he was fighting in this army, he realized that, first of all, it was a colonial army with racial hierarchies. And after the war, he found that he couldn't attract a white French woman to dance with him, even though he just helped to liberate her country. So coming from a place like Martinique shaped him. There was also the fact that the enslaved people of Martinique had been granted their freedom in 1848 with the abolition that was presided over by a man named Victor Schœlcher. And for Fanon, it was kind of a source of shame that Martinique had been, quote unquote, granted its freedom, that it hadn't struggled for its freedom in the manner of Toussaint Louverture and the enslaved people of Haiti.
Right.
And he thought that no freedom that wasn't fought for was worthy of the name.
Once Fanon left Martinique, he was a man on the move. You mentioned Algeria, which is one place he ended up. Why Algeria, and what was happening there at the time that really engaged him?
He ended up in Algeria because he was offered a very good job. It was a plum post for a man who was only 28 years old at the time. He was given this job, this appointed as director of the Blida Joinville Psychiatric Hospital on the outskirts of Algiers, and it was an opportunity, and he went there. But once he got there, he became increasingly interested in the predicament of his Muslim patients and of the Algerian colonized more generally. And 11 months after his arrival, the independence struggle broke out, and Fanon immediately wanted to join it. In fact, originally, he wanted to join it as a fighter, since after all, he'd fought in the Second World War and had fighting skills. But in the end, he ended up providing kind of sanctuary in a clandestine clinic for wounded rebels.
How important was it that Fanon was a psychiatrist? I mean, I don't know if there's a typical profile of a revolutionary, but psychiatrist doesn't really come to the top of my list.
I think the significance of his work as a psychiatrist can't be underestimated, because psychiatry was critical to Fanon's understanding of the colonial condition, of the kind of passivity and self-hatred and sense of futility and despair that form in the hearts and even the bodies of colonized people who have been deprived of independence, of the right to self-governance, the right to their language and culture. And his insights as a psychiatrist infused all of his writing on anti-colonial liberation. His psychiatry and his politics, for the most part, went hand in hand, although there were also tensions between them.
I'm speaking with Adam Schatz, the author of a new biography of Frantz Fanon, entitled The Rebel's Clinic. So, Adam, as you cast your eyes across the world today, where do you see Fanon's impact most clearly?
I think Fanon has had an enormous impact on culture, on African cinema, on post-colonial literature, but he's also had important influence on radical psychiatry in places like Italy, where psychiatrists influenced by Fanon have been working with refugees and migrants. And he's also had quite a significant impact on political movements like the Palestinian movement. Although he never really wrote about Israel-Palestine, he's always been read very closely by Palestinian politicians and by Palestinian critics and writers. He was an important influence on the early PLO because he was read by Abu Iyad, known as, or rather, Salah Khalaf, who declared Wretched of the Earth one of his favorite books. And then later, Edward Said wrote extensively and quite brilliantly about Fanon.
The Palestinian critic, yeah.
Yeah, the Palestinian-American literary critic. And he's also been adopted by Palestinian psychiatrists who work on cases of torture and are interested in the effects of oppression on the psyches of their victims.
Why did you want to write this book, Adam? Why did you want to focus on the life of Frantz Fanon?
I knew of him in my teens because my father had old copies of the original Grove Press editions of Black Skin, White Mass, and Wretched of the Earth. And I also ended up doing a fair amount of reporting in Algeria, a country that had an immense impact on me. I mean, I didn't become a revolutionary. I was not there during an insurgency against a colonial power, but I was deeply affected by my travels there. And I also became aware that Fanon had a different meaning for Algerians today than he had during the time of the independence struggle. He was meaningful to young Algerians precisely because he addressed himself to the failures, the corruption, the autocracy that existed in post-independent states. He predicted this with startling prescience. And so he was looked to by young Algerians. And so the roads in my reporting kept leading to Fanon. And then in 2017, when I wrote a long piece on Fanon's work, this was the height of the Trump era. This was the period in which we were seeing the resurgence of white nationalism and the most brazen, flagrant racism. France was caught up in these very contentious arguments about integration, about Islam, about laïcité. And in these arguments, the name Fanon was often invoked. And I just thought this was a time to revisit the life and legend of this person who has often been reduced to a kind of cartoon figure, a kind of violent and bloodthirsty advocate of armed struggle. And it seemed to me always that Fanon was much more complicated.
That was author Adam Schatz discussing the subject of his new biography, The Rebel's Clinic, The Revolutionary Lives of Frantz Fanon.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.